Hmm? You like that system?
That's great.
Oh, that's marvelous.
Nuclear age.
Yeah. All right. For the sake of the tape and for those who are here for the first time, I'm Roger Field. I work in the national offices of the American Lutheran Church, but in a previous incarnation, I taught church and society at Wartburg Seminary and have cherished the opportunity here to read and recover some of the themes in American intellectual history and how they intersect with the message and the witness of the gospel. Today, we're going to be looking at the theme, Immoral or Just Plain Lost, a look at belief and behavior between the times. And we'll start where we ought to in prayer. Lord, it has never been easy to be a moral people. Not since the fall have we been able to be sure about your will and your way. Help us then to at least be sure that you are bearing witness to your will and way among us. Help us to care about what is moral without presuming to take your position on your behalf. For we ask it in your name. Amen. We've moved in these, for me, final sessions. Today and tomorrow are the final ones. From tracing particular ideas through the context of American history, we've moved from that to some of the combined consequences of those ideas for our day. We've tried to describe our own day as between the times. In other words, that we are in a time in at least American society when the old synthesis of individualism and optimism and opportunity, that which was labeled the American dream, is under severe fire, with more and more people doubting that it ever was true, and a great many doubting that it can currently be true. We are a people who are being forced to question our values, our beliefs, our lifestyle, our secular, and in some cases even our spiritual sources of hope. I quoted in an earlier session Henry F. May, the title of a book he wrote about the years 1912 to 1917. The title was The End of American Innocence, using innocence in that that sense of naivete and unawareness of other trends and processes. And then he subtitled it The Beginning of Our Own Time, suggested that for some of us the beginning of our own time has come quite a bit later, but that for nearly all of us it has now come. We are in the midst of, now you have to fill in the blank, a decline, at least a decline of optimism. President Carter called it a malaise, and after people got done looking that up, they said, yeah, I guess that's true too. A kind of a going to seed, or a kind of an uncertainness, or a kind of a brackishness. We're in the midst of something that doesn't feel good. It is a something that was not brought on by Vietnam, but was hastened by it. And it is a something which may be slowed down by some of the initiatives of President Reagan, some really rather dramatic and creative initiatives. But in spite of that, it will still, most likely, I'm convinced, in fact, it will still be viewed in retrospect as a time of decline from a particular kind of posture. We are between the times in the sense that we are neither what we were nor what we will become. We are between the times, and the end of our uncertainty is nowhere in sight. And those people who plead for quick closure are simply going to be frustrated for a good long time. Now, I need to note one danger, and that's the danger that in every age, people simply exaggerate their own difficulties and declare that it is the crisis time of all ages. I think this is a different kind of crisis, that we really are between the times, and that the between the times doesn't mean between the 50s and the 90s. It means between 300 years of American history and some kind of a new future, that between big chunks of time. I also want to say, though, today and then elaborate tomorrow, it is not Armageddon, except for the nuclear threat. It is not Armageddon. It is not the end of times. And I have no sympathy with those who are apocalyptic in their view of times and say that what we really have to do is brace ourselves to live in the last times. It is it does not seem to me to be any more last times than some other times in the history of the human race. Well, today, let's look at issues of behavior during a time between the times, during a time when common beliefs have been so very much shaken. And let's acknowledge at the outset that a community, whether it is a local community or a national or even a global one, a community has a right to be concerned about belief and behavior. And one of the really devastatingly immoral phrases to come out of the 60s was the one that said, do your own thing. That sense that it shouldn't matter to anybody else what you do simply ignores the needs of community. What is the character of behavior between the times? I want to risk using a rather long analogy, granting in advance that analogies are risky. In fact, it'll almost sound like an allegory because I'll be making so many connecting points. And I realize that if the analogy doesn't hold, then the connecting points won't be very useful either. But one piece of my own training, earlier training in Reformation and Renaissance history, was an introduction to the whole question, what were the prompting factors that led to the kind of flowering of culture and the change in perspective and worldview, which are the kind of hallmarks of the height of the Renaissance, particularly of the Italian Renaissance, of the early Renaissance, 13th, 14th, early 15th centuries in the Italian city-states, and then gradually drifting north and changing character as it did. The traditional, the kind of high school history book way to speak of the Italian Renaissance has been to say that it was a time when people outgrew, when a kind of exuberance outgrew the bonds and the restrictiveness of the medieval time. That the strictures against usury and commerce on the part of the Roman Church and the tendency of ruling classes to try to hold everything in subjection simply gave way to a high interest in commercial things, to cultural interchange and the discovery that there were riches in other cultures, to the development of cities which by their nature were less restrained by the old medieval caste systems and things like that, that it was a time of growth and exuberance and therefore of creativity. Cultural historians always had a kind of a nagging doubt about whether that was the accurate way to understand the Renaissance, but until they started doing a new kind of history, there was not a good way to get hold of that. The new kind of history is sometimes called demographic, or sometimes it's called quantitative history. They started to study the records of those city-states. One of the clues was the discovery that the newer sets of walls around those cities were on a tighter perimeter than the old ones. The cities shrank, not expanded, during the times of the early Renaissance. They start to say to themselves, why did they shrink if this was a time of expansion and opulence and that sort of thing? So then they started looking at tax rolls and the kind of crude censuses that were sometimes taken, discovered what they already should have known from other data, and that was that it was a time of decline in population, an actual gross decline in population, brought on somewhat by warfare, primarily by disease. About a fourth of the population of what we would understand as Mediterranean and Western Europe died off during those terrible plagues. It was a time of great fear of death. That starts to make sense out of the fact that one of the dominant themes of people like Dante and others like that was death and the capriciousness of death and the unpredictability of life. Well, you can go on and spell out a whole set of new indices that historians started to dig out. And they came to a very different kind of conclusion. That the Italian Renaissance was sparked not by the need to throw off the bonds, kind of a 13th century version of Hitler's Lebensraum. It was not that at all. It was a time of great fear and anxiety, a time when they seemed and thought they were living in the last days, when apocalyptic and Armageddon kinds of images were very rampant around them, When they feared that they would live only a short time and live poorly at that, and tried to live to the hilt while they had the chance. And once that kind of sense had been gained of the Renaissance, then you could start to take it apart and take a look at the morphography, the kind of sequence of what happened. And the discovery was that what happened, in fact, was that the Renaissance was the way to try to stem a terrible sense of decline. Not a sense of celebrating some new things, but of trying to stop a decline. And that what they came to do was to deeply doubt that their own day was a useful day and that their own culture was a useful one. That they started on that road, interestingly enough, by claiming that their current language, their current literature, and those sorts of things were inferior. They turned not forward, but backward. One of the first achievements of the Italian Renaissance is the recovery of interest in the classical languages and classical literature. And in fact, one of the earliest achievements of the Italian Renaissance is the discovery of the forgery of the Donation of Constantine. That bedrock on which the Roman Church had built its case that it was the vicar of Christ on earth. Why turn backward? Well, because it was a way of saying we don't need the present. We don't like the way the present is. We turn backward as a way of belittling the present, of saying there was a better time, and if we can't have it now, we'll go back to it. But in fact, they really didn't want to go back either. You could not put back together the splendor that was Rome, and certainly not that which was Greece. Instead, what they were doing was getting ready to leapfrog into an uncertain future under adverse conditions, because they knew they couldn't go back, and they knew that increments of the present weren't going to work. You couldn't just take the present and kind of improve on it. It needed to be disowned, disavowed, left behind. They leapfrogged into an uncertain future under adverse conditions. And they were accompanied in that by a great self-centered anxiety, a terrible pervasive doubt about who they were and what they were supposed to be doing. People who try to hunt for some early roots of what later developed as the discipline of psychology turn back to some of the diary keepers and autobiographical writers of the early Renaissance, and of how they ask questions about themselves, about purpose, about direction, about whether it was important to achieve fame. The word fame really comes of age during the Renaissance. It was also then a time of great variations in behavior. If that age can produce a St. Francis of Assisi at the very beginning, St. Thomas Aquinas, who came at a whole different set of materials, but also a Machiavelli writing The Prince and talking about the whole business that that might makes right, a great variation in behavior and in the limits of behavior. There were limits, but they were very widespread, and the variations were enormous. And people felt that everything that was moral and cohesive and right about life was somehow being torn apart. Or as a much later American writer put it, everything that's nailed down is coming loose. Now, let me try to take the analogy and use it as sort of a framework for talking about our time. We are clearly involved in some degree in the disowning of the present. Surely those who didn't melt down well in the melting pot of the American experience have already taken exception. Blacks, Hispanics, gray power, old people, because one of the things you discover about the American dream is that people weren't supposed to grow old, and so when they did, they started to feel on the outside of the dream. The melting pot, you know, that's that image that the way to become an American was to be melted down and homogenized and come out being carbon copies of each other. Only whites melted, and mostly only Protestants melted well. Catholics didn't melt quite as well, and blacks and Hispanics and people of color never melted at all, and have long since taken issue with the American dream. Those who got only scraps from what Vernon Lewis Parrington called the great barbecue, the urban and rural poor, and to some extent women, and certainly Native Americans, They came quickly to disown the present and say, if this is what the dream is all about, it's not a good dream. But more recently, it has been intellectuals for a variety of reasons. And what's more important, it has been the children of many of the promoters of the old synthesis. The children have come to doubt what the parents were promoting as the ideal. There is a sense in which the new generation is tempted to disown the present, and probably would do that rather quickly if there were a good, viable future laid out there, ready to be inhabited. We have been shaken by that, the disowning of the present by some of the young, in somewhat the same way that the third generation of Puritans were, or the first generation of New England Puritans, were shaken when their children didn't have conversion experiences and still wanted their children, the grandchildren, to be baptized and have a part in the American experience. There is that, what on earth do you do when even our children and our children's children don't see it the way we do? We are in a curious place as a culture, a place where some Americans want to recover a usable past, want to correct the worst excesses. There's nobody that I know of, certainly not in the Reagan administration, and I think not in the moral majority, nobody who's really arguing that we ought to go back to the robber barons and the rape of the land and those sorts of things. It's been tempered, but still wanting to go back and recover a usable past, pick up most of the pieces, the individualism, the sense that people ought to be responsible for themselves, the fact that there ought to be opportunity and you shouldn't simply tax all the profits of it so that nobody can get ahead, that kind of reusable past. There are some who want to do that, while there are some who want to find an alternate future but can't quite see it yet, or propose futures that too many other people think are not viable and therefore there is no good following. But there are very few who savor the moment. Now, this is really pretty important, I think. There are very few who are expressing a sense that the way things are now is the way they ought to be. And that's very instructive. The Gallup poll will periodically surface the question of satisfaction, dissatisfaction. There's been a remarkable rise in the sense of anticipation of satisfaction lately, but it's still a rise in the minor numbers, not anywhere near to a majority. And prior to that, for about 10 years, it had been groveling way down at the bottom of the scale. We are in a curious place. In our bones, we know that our future will not be an increment, just an improvement on the past and present, that great changes are underway. And if I may again quote Alfred North Whitehead, the major changes, he says, advances, the major changes in any civilization almost wreck the societies in which they occur. There's a lot of wreckage laying around, and there is likely to be more. Secondly, using the analogy from the Renaissance, this is a time of self-centeredness and anxiety. We talked yesterday about the anxiety about identity, about how people are hunting around trying to find who they are. Let me pick another title now and another kind of cut at that. I don't know if any of you read Christopher Lash, the historian who is sometimes identified with the New Left. If you do, or even if you don't, I'd like to persuade you to. A relatively new book by Christopher Lash called The Cult of Narcissism. Narcissism, you may recall, is the business of standing in front of a mirror, whether it's actually a glass mirror or whether it means you build a house around you or an empire or whatever. Narcissism is the matter of standing in front of something you created and preening yourself, of dressing the part and trying to present a very brilliant appearance so that when you see yourself, you will be reassured that you matter. Narcissism has that coming back that you're not really trying to impress others. What you're trying to do is impress yourself by impressing others. Christopher Lash, The Cult of Narcissism, suggesting how terribly self-centered a time it is. There's a great deal of acting out. And one of the hallmarks of the acting out of our time is that it is like people who think life is a series of episodes. Marshall McLuhan suggests that television is partly responsible for that. that we tend to encounter life in episodes that have nice frames of 30 minutes or 60 minutes around them. People who watch daytime serials or watch Dallas get a particular sense of that because it is an ongoing story and you just get a little piece of it in the middle. But our lives are some ways characterized as though life were a series of episodes with no string running through them, no connectedness. There is a preoccupation with sexual themes and sexual activities, and a discovery of the internal sexual stresses that come in a time when identity itself is in question. I'll come back to that. There is a relativism about everything, so that experimentation in all sorts of behaviors and lifestyles is tried on the presumption that it's all right to try things. After all, isn't everything relative? Now, let me try to take that the next step. We must be clear. When people talked about the new morality, both its champions and its detractors were, of course, setting it over against an old morality. There was that given kind of split out. But I think that has always gotten us in trouble because it was mistaken. Americans are not yet choosing between a new morality and an old one. We are choosing whether to honor the old one or dishonor it. There is no new one yet to attract us. It has not come together. And when people mistakenly thought that we were choosing between two value systems, that got us into all kinds of trouble because we saw the acting out and thought it was the new system. And we didn't like what we saw. Well, in fact, that's not what it was at all. A new way worth self-discipline has not yet proposed itself coherently enough and publicly enough to be the beckoning way. So we are only choosing whether to honor or dishonor, and part of the problem is that those who have suffered enough have already decided to dishonor, while for those of us who have not suffered enough, and I count myself among them, we are still tempted to honor the old way because it served us fairly well. You know, when people talk to me about suffering, I get very nervous because it is hard for me to see any way that I have really suffered in my lifetime. You know, the fact that we didn't have central heating in a house, that's an inconvenience. You know, the fact that we farmed with horses and later on with an old John Deere with steel lugs, that was improvement. But even at its worst, it was inconvenience. It was never suffering. We've debased the word suffering by using it to describe when we're chilly or when we hurt a little bit or when things don't go quite the way we want them. When OPEC cuts off some of the flow of oil, our society has only been inconvenienced by that. Our economy's been torn to pieces. But in terms of our lifestyle, we've only been inconvenienced so far. I have 4 cylinders instead of 8, but I drive as many miles as I used to. That's inconvenience. We got to be clear about that. Until more of us have suffered enough, we will not dishonor what's base, what's unusable about the present synthesis. Thus, we are like a people who pace the confines of a time between the times. We seem to have too much freedom, but in fact, we are too restrained by anxiety. Let me risk a long illustration. How many of you saw, well, I better test it first. How many of you saw the movie The Graduate? Enough that I can tell the story. I was a parish pastor at the time, and some of our Luther Leaguers persuaded Marilyn and me that we ought to go see The Graduate. And they said, you'll like it. And then I remember one of them saying, I think you'll like it. We came back and we said, we didn't like it. I was, you know, that really was a distressing movie for me. We sat down with that league group and talked about it. They had most of them seen it already. And the breakthrough was when one of the kids said, what was the worst thing about the movie? And I said, the worst thing in the movie, as far as I was concerned, was Mrs. Robinson seducing Dustin Hoffman. Oh, they said, that isn't an important scene in the movie at all. So I said, what are the important scenes? They said, there are two of them. The first one is when he's at his graduation party and his parents make him put on the scuba gear and walk through the swimming pool so that everybody can see how it works. And the other one was when at the very end he breaks up the wedding, you know, when they're at the, if anyone can show just cause why they ought not to be married, that's the point where from the balcony he raises his hand and shouts, and sweeps the bride down the aisle and grabs the cross, the big crucifer, grabs the cross and jams it through the outside of the door bolt so that everybody else is locked inside and he's free. Well, if that's what it's about, then it's a very different movie. I looked at it through a different set of eyes. I'm pacing that time between the times. We're restrained by anxiety. It is not too much freedom that we have in this society. It's too much anxiety. We are really more bound than we are free. Third, in the way of an analogy with that Renaissance one, it is a time that is both destructive and creative. The disowning of the old and the present hurts those who own the present. It is owners who are hurting the worst. Ask those who don't own much, even if they are very old, how they feel about those who are disowning. And they have a different sense. There is the potential for a league between the very young and the very old in this country like there has never been before. It is the ones in between who own who are most threatened. Whether you defend the present proudly or desperately, the disowning of the old hurts those who own the old. And in the process, some valuable things seem to be discarded and are, I think, being discarded. I have some empathy with the new right, both religiously and politically, when it says, whatever happened to the pride in workmanship? What happened to the responsibility for the development of self? Why this abject dependency that says the world owes me a living? What happened to the stability of family structures? Why is it that people just walk away when they don't like a relationship? What happened to the sanctity of property? Those are valuable things that are being thrown overboard. But at the same time that there is that kind of destruction going on, there is creativity going on, there are new thoughts and new experiments, new programs and agendas are being created by those whose will to live reaches beyond despair and hopes that it can hope, but has not yet found out what it can hope in. Beyond and sometimes within the crudeness and the excess of a time between the times, there come those ideas, those initiatives, those programs, that spark of a new synthesis, of a dream fit for our future. I think we probably have most of the pieces laying around already. We're waiting for somebody or some movement to synthesize it. And I think we need to give them space. We need to crave inventions in the social order the way we have craved inventions in the industrial order. We have been an inventing people. We need to adapt that to inventions in the social order. And we need to understand that behavioral conformity is simply not now the highest good. I am reminded over and over again that the scripture chooses to describe King David after his adultery and the murder to cover the adultery. Scripture chooses to call him a man after God's own heart. Not because of his behavioral conformity, in spite of that, in fact, but because he dared to dream and live with the dream of what God was trying to do in his time. We need to understand, I'll repeat it, that behavioral conformity is not the highest good, especially when our survival as a people depends upon change. If people change things that they ought to have left alone, if they mess around with things that are not productive, we at least have to have some sympathy. They are in the process of trying to get beyond our own time. Very briefly, just one other piece. It is a charismatic time, and here I borrow that term in its technical sense, not its religious sense. Max Weber, the German sociologist, is the one whose definition I find helpful. Weber says of charisma, it is the kind of attraction which allows people to suspend their own judgments in favor of that of a leader or a movement. He says charisma in that sense, charismatic leaders and followers of charismatic leaders, they show up for us in times of great social change. They show up between the times because they come forward while everyone else is in kind of disorientation. They come forward and say, lo, this is the way. And there is then a temptation to suspend one's own judgment and say, I don't know, but boy, does he know. Weber uses Hitler as the classic illustration. If you've ever listened to any of Hitler's speeches, I don't understand German, but I don't have to be moved by his speeches. When you listen to the tapes of the Bundestag speech or of the Munich beer hall speeches that he did at one time, especially if you sit in them at the same time as I have, not when he was there, obviously, but I mean sit there and then think about and listen. When you hear Hitler with that fist raised saying, the problem is der Juden, der Juden, it is not hard to understand how a people could be seduced into being anti-Semitic. There is that charisma that says, if he says it, it must be right. Churchill would be chosen as a charismatic kind of person. Franklin Roosevelt could be. Martin Luther King would be. You notice how it can be morally neutral, or it can be very evil, or it can be very good, or somewhere in between. Jim Jones would have to be qualified as a charismatic person. I think the Beatles as a group can be described as charismatic. That is to say, if they said it, it was right for a very large group of people. That's charisma. It takes both a time of bewilderment and a leader or an idea able to capitalize on that bewilderment. And then you have the danger that a time of great hope, because after all, a time between the times can also be a time of great hope, that a time of great hope can be co-opted, seduced, taken away from us by a charismatic leader and have us misused, or we can be taken by the charisma of a person or an idea and move in and inhabit. Well, the potential followers are there in this society. It is not my perception that any leaders or movements have presently presented themselves. But it's a worry that in the wandering, in the disorientation, someone or something may come forward and boldly take charge and take us where we did not plan to go. And so then I want to come to that starting question. Is what we are experiencing immoral or just plain lost? I suppose the best answer is both. But it's the way we get at the answers that matters more than the answers themselves. If our first response to deviant behavior, deviant, the word itself, you know, says the way it is the way it ought to be, and you are deviating from it. If our first response to deviant behavior is to judge it wrong, we are clearly judging that the old way was right. Yet there is abundant evidence that our old ways has some tragic dimensions, if not fatal flaws. So our first response needs to be interest and concern, not judgment. Not a counselor's suspension of judgment for the sake of building rapport and constructive therapy, but the genuine reflection on whether something that is different is moral or not. Not simply judging it by the standards we already have, but trying to judge it in terms of its own merit and on the basis of its own concerns, and thus to probing for a more basic grounding than any current set of societal standards. Now I'm going to use three examples because it's time to get concrete enough so you can really get at me if you want to, or get at the subject. First of all, I'm going to pick that bumper sticker from the late 60s and early 70s that was one of the favorites of the anti-war movement, and that was the one that said, "Make love, not war." You remember seeing it, I think. What I understand that to have been was, in its own way, a moral statement. I think it said something like this: if a society licenses the violation of life by instructing to go to war, surely it's okay to violate just a little bit of flesh, like a sexual moray. If there are people in this society, the upright ones, the leaders, who tell us to kill, surely we have freedom to do some things before we do that, or instead of doing that, that don't kill, that are less violent than that. Make love, not war, was primarily, of course, a war statement. It was only secondarily a sexual one. But so when we approach that kind of statement, we have to approach it, first of all, as a statement that takes the reverence for life seriously. That's the higher moral question. And only when we've taken that seriously, that there was a generation that was grappling with the question of whether it is enough to kill simply because you've been told that it's all right. Only when we've taken that moral question seriously, only then, do we have a right to come back and say, do you realize that in that process, you've tacked onto it a kind of licensing of promiscuity that is, in the long run, not a violation of our rules, but a violation of your flesh. When Paul talks in the New Testament about the inappropriateness of prostitution, he doesn't say that it's terrible that she's a prostitute, and it was always a woman in that kind of situation. What he says is, when you go in and have sex with prostitute, you think it's an episode, a little bead that you can just let lay there, but it's not. You have become one flesh with her, and you have done something to yourself you didn't intend to do. You have scarred your own life. That can be a moral response to the first half of the phrase, make love, not war. But we have to first hear the morality of the concern about whether or not it is right to take life. Let me take another example. This one, also a sexual one, and that has to do with the burgeoning numbers and visibility of homosexuals in this society. It is a mistake for a society to be more distressed about sexual sins than is the Creator. And we are currently, or at least have been, at a stage where, as a society, we are apparently more distressed about this than God is. We must be, because we keep reading judgment into very questionable passages in Scripture in order to prove that God is distressed. We make the Scriptures say more than they say about the subject. The place to start on a subject like this is the recognition that when the cues to identity, I'm going back to yesterday, when the cues to identity have been radically altered or are in flux in a society, people are forced to explore all the latencies in their being. They are forced to explore things about themselves that in a more settled time didn't ever have to be felt or thought about or examined. It ought not to surprise us that the more sensitive and the more honest people in a society in flux are discovering their own sexual ambivalence. If Kinsey is right, and I think the Institute is right at this point, if it is true that for whatever reason, 5% of this population is exclusively homosexual in its attractions, and only 5% is exclusively heterosexual in its attractions, and that all the rest of us lay in that 90% spectrum between, laid out on a kind of a continuum, so that you just can't say they're straight and they're gay, but you've got to talk about that whole range of options, and that the range is there in most people. If that's true, then we just simply have to have more empathy about the fact that in a time when so many identity issues are in question, a lot of people are discovering what they might have been better off not knowing about themselves. And that's the ambivalence of sexual attraction or attraction in a direction that the society chooses to say is wrong. I'll say it another way. I am not devastated to discover that Tennessee Williams is gay. I was trying to think of the Episcopal priest who came out a few years ago. Can anybody pull that?
Malcolm
Boyd. That is not distressing to me to discover that. It does not bother me to believe that 5% of those who kneel with me at the communion rail are exclusively attracted to the same sex, and that's probably true of the people who are administering on the other side of the rail. I am not devastated or even terribly distressed that a substantial minority have a different set of sexual preferences than I have. But I hurt for them, because they are locked into a way of life which includes not only social censure and danger, but the lack of progeny, and they are so overwhelmingly such loving people with so much sensitivity and so much to give. And I fear for their probable loneliness for so much of their lives. The only moral judgment I feel personally I can make about the whole matter of the gay movement is that when someone wants to say gay is good, I want to say no, it isn't. Gay is not good. It is a dimension, a kind of brokenness. Gay is not good, but neither am I. We are only broken in different ways. And that we have to restrain ourselves from laying a whole much larger trip than is deserved on people who are trying to survive and make sense out of life in a time of change. Now, I've chosen two quasi-sexual themes because sexual feelings and behaviors are like fault lines. They are quick to register social crisis. But let me make a similar case for a very different kind of one, and then it'll be your turn. The challenge to the work ethic, to vocational uncertainty, to saving and self-discipline and so forth. The American dream was not ever as noble about some of these things as we thought. The dream was not about prohibiting pleasure, it was about deferring pleasure. It was never about permanent self-denial. Puritans and deists occasionally referred to God's will, but that was more often window dressing than motivation. Most people worked hard, produced, and saved and invested in order to get ahead so they could live the good life. We need to see that the dream itself needs revision, that whatever the new dream is for this land, it needs to be a dream of permanently less and permanently simpler. And then we need to say that the moral question is not, how come you don't work harder? The moral question is, are you being a good steward of yourself, your life, and your skills for the common good? It is not discipline for the sake of reward. It is discipline for the sake of others. Intersections with the gospel. I think I've already woven them into the text, but a couple of principles that I try to lift out. One is this: when both civil religion and its institutional church support are quick to judge what deviates, the gospel and therefore the people of God, the body of Christ, do not quickly judge. For the righteousness of God is beyond both their certainty, meaning the quick judges, and ours. It is risky to say, I am sure this is what God says. The other thing is our Lord identifies so radically and so compassionately with broken people that we simply cannot allow ourselves the luxury of quick judgments, or what's worse, of painless judgments. If it does not hurt us to say what's wrong with someone else, that's a clue that we're saying it from the wrong base and for the wrong reasons. Second and finally, core issues, not social rules, are what matters. We need to grant that a society can't survive unless there are some limits to the options. And if you want to see that in ugly form, read Bill Golding's Lord of the Flies and see what happens when the limits are stripped away. But the questions we ought to ask are like this: does a given behavior move a person or a group toward community or toward isolation? Does a given lifestyle conserve and construct or consume and destroy? Does a given loyalty or obedience contribute to the wholeness of the world community? Or does it instead contribute to fortifying a smaller piece of turf? Are we circling the wagons or joining the wholeness of creation? Your turn. I end with questions, obviously. Please.
In the leadership movement that you spoke of, Hitler and so on and so on, I wonder if you could give us your thoughts on the Moonies. This is a very threatening and frightening thing as far as I'm concerned.
Could I broaden the question so that it's really thoughts on cult movements generally?
Yes.
I think maybe that's the better way to come at that. It would appear to me that right now we are in the low here, low there stage, you know? The warning about false prophets that says, and in those times false prophets will come and they will say low here and low there. I think that's what's happening. There is a terrible hunger for someone or some idea which will organize existence. I described that episode business earlier. People are doing life in kind of episodes, but they're not liking it. Someone said about sexuality, are we doing it more and enjoying it less? There is that sense that there's no good framework. So when a cult comes along and offers a whole ready-made framework, there is an initial tendency to jump into it, because the Moonies certainly fit that Max Weber definition of where you suspend your judgment in favor of the judgment of a leader. But none of them, nor even the accumulation of them, seems yet to be the new way. They seem to be to carry their own seeds of destruction. They do one of two things. They burn out quickly, or they quickly become conventional. And you notice that the Moonies are not in the airports as much anymore, and they've gone public about saying they're going to raise money a different way, and families can now visit the initiates, and that, you know, that whole business about joining the mainstream because it was cold out there. I don't think that's finally where it's going to come. But the new way is likely to be as radical as that. In our bones, what we want is a conservative change, a kind of a management of adjusting and coping. And what we fear is a revolution, and what we are likely to have is a revolution that leaves behind in the wilderness those of us who can't go with it.
You're speaking of a bloodless revolution.
Yes, yes, that's right. Whitehead talks about wreckage. I think we could equally well talk about the flow of blood. It will be a very bloody time. The casualties will be all around.
What do you see by way of radical changes in the life of the mainline churches? The wreckage that might come about there.
That's tomorrow's topic, but I'm willing to preview. Tomorrow we talk about the servant church, a song both old and new. The temptation for the churches right now is to circle the wagons, to try to conserve and strengthen. We count the numbers and worry that people are leaving and don't take seriously enough that most of those who are leaving weren't ever there. We're coming out of a time. Well, let's start another way. At the time of the American Revolution, 16% of the adult population of the new nation belonged to any organized church. 16. The high point of church membership ever in the life of this society was the middle 1950s, when something over two-thirds belonged to churches and something over 50% attended on a given Sunday. We grew up with that, so we think that's the kind of, you know, that's the way it ought to be, and everything else looks like a terrible crisis. What's not? We're going back to the business of being the people who gather to be fed and go out to minister. And we'll just have to get used to that. The clue ought to be in the fact that we're losing members but not money. You know, the ones who are leaving never gave much to start with, either of themselves or their money. So it'll be a mistake for us to circle the wagons.
Roger. But don't your earlier words suggest that it's going to be well nigh impossible for the mainline churches representing that part of society who have to really do anything but circle the wagons, since we're going to be, if the changes that you're talking about and the change that has to come in our society comes, that they are the ones that are going to have to, or we, I include myself, I suppose, in that group, are the ones that are going to have to give something up, and yet your directions, your connections seem to say that we are also going to be the people who resist giving up.
Yeah.
Seems to me to be an untenable position. They have to give up, and yet they can't give up.
It is an untenable one in one sense. And that's the question is, how much is the church an institution and therefore bound by the slow inertia of institutions versus how much is the church of the gathering of people around some radical ideas which can be reclothed for different times? I guess that since the quest is so spiritual, and that's the other thing that makes the cult so attractive, it really is a spiritual quest for a dream, for an idea, because you can't live with just stark reality. We have a right to dreams. God gives us dreams to dream. There is the possibility that at least an intact piece of the church can adapt from a kind of a homeland theology to a kind of a pilgrim moving through new land or moving toward a new place, that it can adapt without having to totally disband and start over. It seems to me that the resurgence of interest in not so much religion as the resurgence of interest in ideas is a kind of a hopeful thing. Bible class that I teach in the church where we belong, we one year decided to depart from just straight Bible study and went to a year-long study of the first 21 articles of the Augsburg Confession. It was remarkable the number of high school and post-high school kids who joined us during that study and left us as soon as we went back to straight Bible study. But came because we were grappling with a framework of ideas, and they were hunting for something like that. So I guess I don't despair of the possibility that at least recognizable segments of the institutional church don't have to be left behind. But that may be more optimism than realism. I grant you.
Can I just add one other analogy to it? It reminds me a little bit of what I was talking about the other day on Monday in change
in
psychotherapy. That so often we want to change, and so often we sometimes have the initial awareness that we need to change, but the real business of change, the real gut-wrenching struggle and acceptance of the new and giving up of the security of the old is so difficult that the vast majority of us drop out of that.
Yeah, that's right. What I suspect is that there's more Darwinism in what's going to happen than we care to admit. And that is that finally the will to live and to have life count for something will become such a driving force that those who have that will to live will find a way. They will put it together and they will shuck off the kind of triage that leaves behind whatever can't change fast enough. That triage will happen. And I don't know which of us get left behind and which of us get to go along. Marilyn.
You said a couple times that you believe that it will be the young, and you mentioned today the very old, who aren't invested in the current way things are, who will be the ones who will join the movements for change. Now, I see a real paradox, or I see a real contradiction in the last 10 years or so with the kind of new conservatism that has been on campuses, for example, with, I would say that most of the people I knew while I was going to college were not at all interested in a new vision for the future, but were interested in living out a very status quo vision.
Yeah.
And they're trying to invest themselves and own as much as they can. How do you read that trend?
That is scary. I listen to particularly people from our seminaries who are recruiting on college campuses. And they reflect that same sort of experience with those who are college students now. And we experience with seminarians and graduating seminarians a remarkable, distressing amount of institutional security or search for security. But I guess my sense of that is that they have not returned to the old conservatism quite. They've returned to the economic piece of it and the dependency piece of it. But in terms of sexual mores, in terms of self-discipline, they have not gone back. It's only in part a going back. It's a reversion for the sake of security, not really out of a love of the way things were. It is not the reincarnation of the American dream, as much as it is a kind of a commuting between fear and hope. And right now we're at the piece of the commute that's back toward the way, wondering whether the old way will work. I think that we'll see that tip over again. The activism of the 60s did not have to be triggered by Vietnam. It was already well underway. It was triggered, if anything, around 1960, and triggered symptomatically showed up in music, it showed up in sexual mores, it showed up in lifestyle issues. Vietnam hastened and made it a bitterer kind of thing. But it was underway without that, and I think it'll happen again. But it is a strange commute. It is just like back and forth. Some more. Time for a couple more. Please.
What kind of timetable do you feel? You know, how long am I going to struggle? Or am I going to survive? Or will I be a noble?
I'm not as sure of the timetable as I am of that other piece, and that's the question about how much do we have to suffer. We have to get beyond being inconvenienced.
I know that the next group does that.
For the sake of the tape, she said, I'd rather the next group do that. those who can, who have the the vote and the moxie at organization to effect change have to have suffered, and we have not yet. I think it will happen quite soon. I think the energy issues, the population issues, things like that will force us rather quickly. I think it will be before the end of this century that we will bottom through the business of learning to suffer with the rest of the world and then hunting for common solutions. But it's not going to happen in a few years. In fact, I think that our present commute back toward the old way is going to look like a popcorn break, a kind of an interlude during which we give that old way one more try. Paul.
That's the scenario I would guess at, too. I'm, like Marilyn, not at all sure that if we had a triggering event like Vietnam, that it would be a trigger. I don't think people would I'm very fearful that people would not respond to a crisis like that with any really independent thought and re-examination of where we've been coming from as a nation. I think the only thing that's going to shake people is a very long economic deterioration.
Yeah.
But it isn't clear to me what that's going to cause any real reshaping of people's morality other than around a conservation ethic. That seems to be very clear.
Yeah.
But other than that, I could imagine us in 2025 as American dream-like in every other respect, and as the stable old morality-oriented as we were 20 years ago, the 50s.
The morality piece, in the sense of a commonly held code of ethics, that will come late. Survival will come first.
Will it come at all? I see no reason to think that we're on a chain into a century where there's going to be any serious change in that respect at all.
Well,
we may be in for a very conservative 100 years.
I tend to think that what happens is that whenever a people goes through a sufficient crisis that survival itself is the issue, and then does survive and come into a new relative equilibrium, then it does construct a morality that supports that equilibrium. It does construct a set of values. And it's in that sense, you know, I mean morality here in a very human sense of constructing a set of rules to support something that finally feels good enough to be worth conserving. Not morality necessarily in the sense of reference to Creator.
Why wouldn't that be the traditional family?
It could be.
Sexual morality?
It could be. I want to grant that it could be that we'll fumble along with an exceptionally conservative morality coupled with the need for some very radical lifestyle changes.
Larry Rasmussen talks, I guess, his book about economic anxiety, you know, about kind of that circling of the wagons in light of the nations, not, you know, capitalistic nations as well as socialistic nations, that ones that have acquired something, you know, are now the major common concern is one of defending what we have, security. And, you know, let's make sure, you know, again, the arms build up and doing that. And where, you know, does that leave even, you know, the countries that are the without at this point, they're going to have to revert to even more violent ways in order to rattle the cages of those nations that do have and that are trying to protect more. We could be open, you know, the whole thing of terrorism, you know, one person or a small group can do an awful lot.
Yes.
You know, that seems to be probably a wave that you just can't handle. You just can't shut that down with a bigger military.
No. By the way, terrorism was a hallmark of the early Italian Renaissance, too.
It's a parallel.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Let me use a risky illustration. I think it would be tragic if our nation were to discover the presence of and the technology to make use of sufficient non-renewable energy sources so that it didn't matter to us whether the rest of the world didn't have any. We have to be forced into the business of using technology to try to discover both a lifestyle and the renewable sources that the whole world can use. It would be tragic if we could somehow weave ourselves a cocoon and be protected from what for the rest of the world is just a tragic situation.
South Africa is almost done.
Yeah. Well, we've run out of time. Tomorrow we go at the church's institution and the church's mission. See you then.